and welcome to Worlds Apart. For the first time since the end of the Cold War, the United States has engaged with its proclaimed adversary, Russia, without setting any value-laden preconditions, signifying a dramatic change in America's diplomatic and policy stance. Is it likely to hold and be extended to other nations? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Mushahid Hussain Sayed, former Pakistani senator and chairman of the Pakistan-China Institute. It's a great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Welcome to Pakistan.
Thank you. It's amazing to be here, especially at this point of time. I do want to discuss the recent changes in American and global politics with you, because I know that even before Trump won his second term, you were in the minority in claiming that he wasn't just a rowdy showman, but he had a genuine potential of bringing some positive change in global affairs. Are you still optimistic about that?
No, I'm very pleased with what happened in the United States of America on 5th November. The victory of Trump, which I predicted a year in advance, and also supported Trump that he will be good for world peace.
Why?
First of all, he is the first American president after John F. Kennedy who does not represent the American security establishment. In fact, the deep state and the establishment is against him. So he's a tough guy, he's shown the resilience. Secondly, his worldview. What does he stand for? He's not a cold warrior. He's not a warmonger. He wants to end all wars. He doesn't see enemies like the American establishment does. He says, President Putin is my friend. Kim Jong-un is my friend. Xi Jinping is my friend. That's positive. He wants to have an outreach and a good relationship with major countries of the world.
Let's try to draw some conclusions from this latest meeting in Riyadh. I'm sure you followed some of the developments. And what struck me is that apart from some concrete agreements that were reached there, it also showed that America is capable of an actual diplomatic dialogue, not a top-down lecturing, you know, we tell you what to do, but actually sitting down with negotiating partners at the same table and engaging in a process, arduous process of negotiation, because, you know, all the previous administrations that I remember, they treated that presence at the talks as a reward for the other party for behaving, you know, good enough for them. I think that's a major change, don't you think so?
Yes, and also I think Trump is more honest than most American politicians. He's the one who's exposed the lies, the deceit, and the corruption in the American system. Everybody else said, no, the war was started because of Putin. No, he said the war was started because of NATO expansion. That's the truth. And also, he's the one who's willing to have a dialogue. All issues can only be solved. He had the ceasefire in the Middle East. He started the dialogue process. And he told Zelensky, look here, you passed your mandate. And you have to contest the elections. So I think that's a very honest, upright. We needed somebody like that who's not a hypocritical person like Biden and like the other predecessors.
Now, the American diplomats and politicians do have a certain culture. You can call it depletious or whatever, but Donald Trump definitely comes as somebody who brings very, very unusual approach. I wonder, you as a politician and also to some extent as a diplomat, don't you think that that perhaps takes away from the public profession when somebody who has no governing experience comes in and makes so many changes in a matter of a couple of weeks, something that was so stale for many, many years?
No, that culture you talked about is a very fake culture. It's a culture conceived by the military-industrial complex in the United States, where the diplomats, the politicians, and the media people all follow what I call the officially certified truth. Okay, Russia is the enemy, China is the enemy, or Muslims are the enemy.
And we are the good guys.
And we are the good guys and the bad guys. And they are Democrats and the rest are autocrats. That's not the world how it is. The world is more complicated than that. And that's a simplistic view to convey, because the military-industrial complex in America is like a permanent war machine. They need an enemy. So they had the Soviet Union. After Soviet Union, it was Muslims. after the Muslims, now it's China's turn, and also again Russia. And what is the justification for NATO even, frankly? NATO is a relic of the Cold War.
Well, maybe the justification for NATO is to continue the Cold War.
So that's no justification. For us in the Global South, we reject that. It is of no value. So I think Trump is a breath of fresh air. He's willing to dialogue. I think it's a very positive step for peace that there is a meeting in Saudi Arabia between Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Rubio, and which will be the precursor of the summit between President Putin and President Trump. And that is the need of the hour.
Let me ask you also about the Saudi role here, because I find that Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, as a place for these historic talks has certain amount of historic symbolism, because it was Saudi manipulations with the oil prices back in the late 1980s that sort of contributed to the Soviet economic collapse. But it was also Saudi Arabia and its cooperation with Russia within the APEC Plus format that allowed Russia to sustain its economic capacity under Western pressure. So it seems that the Saudis are playing sort of an undertone, but still a very important role here. How do you understand it?
I think the Saudi Arabia role is very positive. And you have seen a silent revolution in Saudi Arabia under their new leader. His name is Mohammed bin Salman. He's the crown prince, he's the prime minister, and he has changed everything topsy-turvy for them. When Biden went there after the Ukraine conflict began, and Biden told him to raise the oil prices and oil production, he refused. And he went along with Putin, not with Biden.
Well, he didn't go along with Putin. He just went along with his own interests.
Yes, because it's
in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
There was a choice given. Biden gave him one advice. President Putin gave him another advice. He chose not Biden, but he chose President Putin. Yes, in his own interest, in the interest of the Saudi Arabian economy. So that's very positive. Saudi Arabia is no longer an extension of American foreign policy.
Absolutely. And they also have ambitions to play a mediating role. They are public about it, between the United States and Iran. A couple of months ago, I would find it a joke. You know, the Saudis are trying to bring the Iranians and the Americans together, but... These days, nothing seems possible. What do you think about that prospect of the Sunnis, some would say very hardline Sunnis, bring together both the Americans and their Shia Muslim neighbors?
A year ago, a very historic development took place in the Middle East. Iran-Saudi rapprochement, brokered by the People's Republic of China. They're normalized. And who did it? Not Washington, D.C., not London.
Well, not Washington under Biden.
Yes. So, no.
So and he's enlightened changed. Leadership.
Yes. That has changed. So that means there are new forces at play.
Do you think, though, that we've been talking about, how much Trump is a game changer, but do you think Trump himself, his emergence onto the global stage, was to some extent preceded by, by the developments that you just mentioned, that these forces of new thinking, reconciliation, normalization of foreign policy have come into play even before Trump was elected?
Yes, Trump knew a basic reality, which we in the Global South had been pointing out, or some of us, that America and the West is in decline. And the global balance of economic and political power is shifting from the West, as we know it, US and Europe, to the Global South, which is a new reality. So that reality was being missed by the traditional Washington establishment.
Can I ask you, you mentioned Europe just now, and I find it paradoxical that some of the Muslim countries we just mentioned are in favor of normalizing the US-Russia relations, but Europe, which is much closer to the Ukrainian conflict, is still in favor of continuing that war. How do you explain it for yourself?
Europe is dead and gone. Europe is irrelevant. Europe has collapsed. Look at the dishonesty of Europeans. When the Nord Stream 2, this pipeline, was blown up by the Americans, according to Seymour Hersh, the top American journalist, he said it was a covert operation of the CIA. They didn't say a word on that. They didn't have the moral courage to speak the truth. And here was an act of actual energy terrorism. Nord Stream 2 was providing energy for Europe from Russia. And it was blown up by the Americans covertly. And 7th of February 2022, Biden publicly threatened that it will cease to exist. And the Europeans, not a squeak out of them.
I think there was a lot of also emotional reaction and posturing coming out of the European Union after Trump's vice president delivered that scolding and schooling to them at the Munich Security Conference, criticizing their own democratic record. Now, I know that you are very passionate about governance, genuine, inclusive governance. What was it like for you as a Pakistani to hear the Americans lecturing Europeans and criticizing Europeans on their democratic record?
You know, I want to be very frank. After what has happened in the Gaza genocide, and I tell the European ambassadors or the Western ambassadors I meet in Islamabad, I said, please cut this nonsense and double standards. You are accomplices and complicit in these crimes. And you talk of human rights in about Russia or China or Ukraine.
Or Pakistan. So,
or Pakistan. Means. We don't want to listen to this. I'm sorry. This is nonsense. So I think J.D. Vance, I compliment the American vice president. He spoke the home truths on European soil to the Europeans in their heartland in the Munich Security Conference. And he showed them the mirror. And they didn't like it because it shows an ugly face of Europe, which has been hidden in the facade of rhetoric, verbiage, rules-based order, human rights,
and also
civil
privilege
liberties.
And legacy. I mean, it's good to think of yourself as the sort of
for God's there's no
the
time
only
for
hope
this.
Of humanity.
Yeah.
Can I ask you though? I've heard some analysts say that Europe at this point of time has a choice between being right, that is staying the old course, or being relevant. And if they want to be relevant, they will also have to be a little bit humble and perhaps self-critical as well. Which way do you think they are likely to lean at this point?
They should be on the right side of history. They should learn from a great European whom I respect a lot. His name was General Charles de Gaulle. De Gaulle was the first European statesman after World War II who talked of strategic autonomy for Europe, a European Europe in the 60s. And he was the first to recognize, as you know, in 1964, the People's Republic of China had an opening to the then Soviet Union also. That's what is need of the hour. Instead of being America's poodle, they have been America's poodle for too long.
He was a true cosmopolitan with the European identity. Exactly. He retained his identity.
So he had that gravitas, that stature, and that vision to take Europe forward. Not these pygmies and these poodles who have been following America, and now they've been dumped by the Americans.
Well, we are not dumped, but we have to take a very short break at this time. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
And what planet are we living on, man?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Mujahid Hussain Sayed, former Pakistani senator and chairman of the Pakistan-China
Institute. I'm also former minister for information and culture.
Absolutely. That's why you're so eloquent on these affairs.
Just for you.
Can I take us back for a question or two to the talks in Riyadh? Because what's interesting there was that Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, who was very instrumental in reaching the Abraham Accord, also played a key role in liaisoning between Trump and Putin at this point of time. And I wonder if you see any connections, not only personal connections there, but connections between war theaters. Do you think there could be any sort of possible ties and solutions, synergies between bringing to an end the Ukrainian war, let's say the Gaza conflict, perhaps the developments in Syria and Iran? Do you see any larger sort of interlinkages here?
Oh, yes, it certainly is. No, people think that Trump is just a person who's unpredictable and he's just hopping from one issue to another. No, he has a broad worldview and a grand plan where there are linkages between conflicts that he would like to diffuse first and resolve. And so the choice of the Middle East as the venue for Ukraine peace is very crucial, because this is going to be the stepping stone. Peace in Europe, peace in the Middle East. And Steve Witkoff is a person with no diplomatic background.
Absolutely.
He's a billionaire
that
like Trump.
That seems to be very effective.
Yes. And he is his buddy playing golf. And how did he behave with Netanyahu? 11th of January, he got this message from his boss, Trump, that before I take office as president on 20th of January, I want a ceasefire in Gaza. And it was 11th of January. It was Saturday, a Sabbath, which is a Jewish holiday. And Netanyahu refused to meet him. He said, oh, it's a holiday. He said, look here, I'm also a Jew like you. You better come there or else. So it's like the American, you know, Western movies, you know, they have the cowboys with the pistol. Said, do it or else. And that's how he threatened, because otherwise Netanyahu is a bit of a gangster himself, and he got browbeaten by this chap, and he got the ceasefire.
I know that you believe that he can curb the influence of figures like Benjamin Netanyahu, but...
But he did on that occasion.
On that occasion, yes, but we are also hearing both Prime Minister Netanyahu and many of the officials in his cabinet use increasingly religious, insightful language, like, for example, Netanyahu talking about the Lion of Judah roaring and the roar being heard across the region. And we know that in the Bible, it continues that this lion will not be pacified until he drinks the blood of his victims and, you know, consumes their corpses. So that's a very dangerous and insightful rhetoric. And I find it somewhat paradoxical, because I think a lot of the Muslim countries that, you know, expressly religious Muslim countries, they're very careful about separating the religious and spiritual domain from the governance and political domain. But Israel and the Israeli politicians, it looks to me at least, they are deliberately enmeshing the two. How do you explain that?
You see, Netanyahu is using religion in a very crass, in a very crude form to retain his legitimacy with his narrow Jewish religious extremist base, which is weakened from within because of the failure of Netanyahu to crush the Palestinian resistance, namely in Hamas. And he said before he started this war that I will decimate, I will exterminate, I will eliminate Hamas. And at the end of the day, he's negotiating with Hamas on hostages through the CIA, through the Egyptian intelligence, through the Qatari intelligence. So he has failed in his primary mission. So to make up for that, he's still trying to galvanize the remnants of this religious...
So he's compensating with the rhetoric,
yes,
for
exactly
the actual...
And to just to hold on to that.
And yet, I think many people feel very bitter about the current position of the Palestinians in this conflict and Trump's proposal to resettle them. And this is a very complicated issue, because on the one hand, it sounds offensive that people need to be moved to some other places. But on the other hand, you know, I think it's also not very humane to use people as placeholders for the historical promise that other countries...
This is a very outlandish, out-of-the-mind proposal. It's just, it's a non-serious proposal. But basically, Trump's style is that it's a shock and awe. He's
to galvanize
He scares the hell out of everybody with a very extreme position.
Okay,
And then he uses that as a bargaining chip to let's talk now.
Okay, in case this interview somehow reaches his advisors or him personally, do you see any scenario that would be respectful to the historical promises that were made at the founding of Israel, that would be respectful to the human realities on the ground, that the Palestinians can also leave rather than survive, but also take into account Israel's defense sensibilities?
Actually, the situation has turned around now. It's not about Israeli defense. Israel is the oppressor, and the Palestinians are oppressed. The tables have turned. What you're saying in 48 does not apply in 2025. And the 2025 is that Gaza genocide has shown, people said might is right. That failed. Right is might. And right means the right of self-determination of the people of Palestine.
Do you think Trump agrees with you on that?
Trump or no Trump, one thing is very clear. The ground realities are paramount. And Trump is one person who is not ideological. He's basically a businessman. His book is Art of the Deal. So he starts from the premise, what is on the ground? And on the ground, the Arab countries and the Palestinians are unified on one issue. Till there's a Palestinian state, there is no lasting peace, security, stability in the Middle East.
Speaking about possible deals, I've heard some Russian analysts in my country speculating that one of the reasons why Russia was so essentially took a backseat when the government of Syria was decimating, was falling down, was because there's somehow a deal underway that would allow for the reconstruction of Syria. It requires a lot of money, some estimates around $4 billion.
Even more.
Perhaps even more. In order to be reconstructed, Syria would also need new people. And the Syrians and the Palestinians, they used to be part of the Levant. So it's ethnically and culturally, those are very close people. And the speculation is that there may be some sort of a deal under the carpet that would secure financing for Syria, for its reconstruction, perhaps from some of the Gulf states, but would also move some of the Palestinians, at least temporary, to Syria. Do you think that something like this could be possible?
Two things. Reconstruction in Syria, yes, there's a plan for that. But linking it with the Palestinian issue, no. No Arab country would be in a position to play that role, whether it's Egypt, Jordan, or Syria. Palestinians, whether in the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank, stay where they are. And that is going to be the bottom line, led by Saudi Arabia itself. So even the Saudis are very clear on that. So I think that's a pipe dream, if anybody has that. Reconstruction, yes. And let's not forget, it was the Russian forces in Syria which destroyed Daesh, the Islamic State.
Yeah.
And certainly now it's surfaced again from somewhere by some other forces, it seems, even in Afghanistan.
How do you understand then the Russian and perhaps also the Chinese position on the fall of the Assad government? Because they very conspicuously did not intervene, unlike their very active intervention a couple of years prior.
I think the Assad regime collapsed on its own weight. They were unable. If a regime is unable to defend itself, they had to, and they had to run for exile. And this we have seen before also. It happened in Afghanistan also. Ashraf Ghani was their president. He flew off to UAE and Tajikistan. Assad also did the same. And Russia and China did the right thing. They helped them in the most difficult period when they were facing the threat of terrorism. But when the regime could not hold its own, the state apparatus or the army, then the regime deserved to go.
How do you explain, how do you expect the Syrian situation develop from now on? Because apparently the Russians are also in talks now, diplomatic talks with the new interim government. It has some ties with Turkey. It's in some communication with other regional actors. What is the future of Syria? How is the future of Syria looking for you?
I'm optimistic. I feel that the new Syrian regime, although it's cobbled different factions together, they are very, very pragmatic. They have said that we do not want another war. We want reconstruction. And with Russia, they are very positive. Their Russian base in Tartush is still there, other communication. And they say we want to build a normal relationship with Russia and with China also. The only, I think, problem they will have is with Iran. Not with other countries, and perhaps later with the United States, because the U.S. still has forces occupying Syrian territory. And that's a problem not just for Syria, it's also a problem for Turkey, because the American forces there are aligned with the Kurdish elements who are against the government of Turkey.
Now, you mentioned Afghanistan, and the American influence here, or in this part of the world, was, well, I think it's fair to describe it as detrimental for quite some time. And yet, Afghanistan is a very rich country in terms of mineral resources. It has lots of rare earths. I know that it's a popular word in the White House these days. Do you see any sort of American engagement in the region, mercantile, non-mercantile? But do you think it would be a good thing if Trump turns his eyes towards Afghanistan again?
I hope he turns his eyes in a non-military sense, because the military intervention has totally failed. 20 years after 9/11, the U.S. squandered $2.2 trillion in Afghanistan. And you saw the humiliating exit. You have Mike Waltz, who is the national security advisor to Trump, who served for 3 times in the American army. He knows it. So I expect the Americans to re-engage under Trump with Afghanistan once he has sorted out Ukraine and Middle East. And that re-engagement would not be military. It will be positive. And they would have the eyes on this. People say $5 trillion. $6 trillion of rare earth or whatever you call it. And Afghanistan is also very strategic because it's close to Russia, it's close to Central Asian republics, it's close to China and Iran and Pakistan.
I cannot finish this conversation without asking you specifically about China, because sometimes Trump has been, well, rather, I wouldn't call it crude, but very tough-minded on China. Do you think there are any new vistas for these two countries, or perhaps a somewhat new way of relating to one another? Do you see that in the works?
I have already predicted. I've been to China many times. I'm not a specialist on China. I'm a student of China, shall we say.
Well, you're still the chairman of the Pakistan-China Institute.
So, and I've been there in the last 50 years, almost 100 times as a student. I went there first time. And I think that Trump knows that you cannot contain China. Trump knows you cannot confront China or have a new Cold War, because China has moved ahead very fast. Trump will re-engage with China on new economic terms. And don't forget, Trump's right-hand man is a guy called Elon Musk, who is the China man in the Trump administration, and who's close to Beijing also. So they have a very key connection there through Elon Musk. And I feel that Trump, he invited Xi Jinping to his inauguration.
So I'm sorry for interrupting, but do I understand you correctly? It's a matter of not dictating, but finding new areas to engage and finding a new tone for conversation.
Yes, especially in economic interaction. And don't forget, Trump is dying and fishing for an invitation to visit Beijing. And Chinese are playing coy, like a reluctant debutante. And they said, OK.
Well, maybe they need some Saudis involvement here as well.
So I think they'll do that. They're also very sharp and pragmatic in that. So I think that they will find a place for re-engagement. But remember, no new Cold War. And I don't see him he'll try to work out a deal which is mutually beneficial. And the Chinese know how to do that also with the Americans.
Okay. Well, that's a very...
They're ready for that, I think.
Very optimistic view of the world. Let's see if it plays out. Thank you very much.
Thank
for
you. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much. And good luck to you.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on The Worlds Apart.